Welcome back to the Iron Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us for this guest episode. What an awesome one we've got for you. Matthew Saeed, ex-top ranked, I think in the world, table tennis player, innovative thinker, loads of great books in there as well. So an author too, Black Box Thinking, Rebel Ideas, The Greatest, just so many really, really fascinating ideas. And he's someone that's dug deep into loads of stuff. But I really love just the way this conversation went in general, just the feel of it. Sparks, what did you think?
Yeah, awesome. Like Matthew's background in journalism definitely comes through, because he basically is the first person to add any sort of shape and format to our attempt to have a conversation, which was super nice, because normally it's an absolute chaos.
Yeah.
But it was really cool. And like I said, the books he's written, and also his books for kids, What Do You Think? And You Are Awesome, and Dare to Be You. I actually, without any real attempt to do this, actually had a couple of those.
Oh, nice.
Without actually lying to Matthew about having them, but it did actually. So yeah, absolutely awesome conversation, and probably one of my favorite ones so far. This I'm going to call it a season.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, series. Yeah, or something like that. Season's nice. The conversation was quite interesting, the way that it found its natural form. I was very interested just to find out some of his thoughts on potential and with what he'd explored, especially with his kind of different ways of thinking and everything. But what we ended up doing was found our way directly to the conversation around bringing out the best in ourselves, but more importantly, bringing out the best in each other. So it quickly formed to a lot of stuff around coaching, around group work, sort of communities, how they work, inspiring figures, and what it takes to, I guess, to start to create a new environment or transform the one you're in.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest takeaways for me was just actually Matthew's story on its own is an actually incredible story. With, I'm not going to leave any spoilers, but his whole progression of how he ended up where he was is an incredible story.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, so I hope you really enjoy it. Look out for Number One Living Drinks. That's my drinks, numberoneliving.com. The code IAM20, capitals and the number 20, gets you 20% off a load of stuff. We've got tasting great. That's great for your health and your gut, and might just be part of an awesome transformation in your life. But certainly this podcast here and this episode is a great one for gently exploring some really big topics. We get to talk about some pretty cool people in that as well, especially Steve Black, who was big for both of us. He comes up in there quite a lot, which was a nice touch.
Yeah, that was nice.
All right. So enjoy the episode, and thanks for your support. Keep us posted with what you think, what you feel, and take care. Matthew Saeed, thank you for coming and joining us on the I Am podcast. I think this is going to be a brilliant chat, and giving us your time. Very, very kind of you. And hopefully we can dig deep with some amazing insights. First of all, how are you?
I'm well, and thanks for having me on, Johnny. It's great to connect with you for the first time as well, Sparks. Johnny, I think I'm right in saying we've met once before.
It rings a bell.
Is that right? I came to interview you, if memory serves. And you were, I think, still playing, in fact, you were still playing rugby at the time. And It was fascinating for me. I've been lucky enough to interview a lot of top sports people over the years. And what really stuck with me was your honesty, but also you said that you had practiced that morning or the day before and you had kicked, 99% of the conversions had gone in, but you had missed one. And you watch television the night before and you're looking at the screen but not actually taking any of it in, because you're replaying the miss over and over. And it stayed with me ever since. So, I'll say whatever I can to add, insight to the podcast. But I'm looking forward to hearing both of your thoughts as well.
Let's let this be part of it. We'll get right into it, because my brother would know a lot about this. Christmas Day, we used to go to the training ground in Newcastle, often snowing. Sparks, you'd be happy to sort of kick balls with me and then stand behind the post and
assume my normal position of under the posts, kicking it back.
And then we'd do a whole session, and it would come down to the last couple. And if I miss one, depending on how bad the miss was, it would be oof in the balance. And if I missed a second one on top of that miss, it would be
major problems, at which point Sparks, you could see his face is now thinking, no, please don't. And I'm like, right, that's it, we're starting again. Yeah. And this was an hour and a half, and then that would mean at least another 45 minutes just because of that miss at the end. That's how, I mean, we'll talk about this in the podcast, but that's how bad it got in terms of just, yes, there's a degree of devotion and motivation and purpose and drive and all that kind of stuff, but there's also a massive lack of trust.
But you know, let me just slow down a sec, because okay, I'm fascinated in that, but there is something else as a parent that is perhaps even more interesting about what you've said so far, and you might not be aware of it, but I bet every parent is thinking this. Your brothers, that's correct. Yeah. Who's the older brother?
That'll be me.
Sparks, you're older. How many years older?
18 months.
Okay. So you are brothers. Now, I've got a son and a daughter. They get on well most of the time, but there's a lot of sibling rivalry. And yet you went to the training pitch. Johnny's taking the shots. You're standing behind the posts and feeding, if I understood that correctly, and feeding it back. So in other words, you are effectively a helper. You're giving up your time to nurture and coax the talent of your brother. That honestly, as a parent, your parents, I hope they're still listening to that. That's a wonderful and beautiful thing to hear. And it's not necessarily that common in your teens. You could have been out having a laugh with your mates. You could have been doing things that you wanted to do. But there's a bit of self-sacrifice there. I shouldn't take over the podcast.
No.
But honestly, as a journalist, that is really interesting to understand the strength of the relationship at that point in your lives that you're prepared to do it.
Well, I inadvertently became quite good at kicking. So it actually benefited me down the line. I didn't get anything out of it. But
yeah, I was going to say, we saw in the new year, not the millennium, but we saw 1999 in by kicking on the back pitch at Kingston Park up in Newcastle under the floodlights. That's how we saw the new year in.
Wow.
Because it's a lot, like I said, a huge amount of it was passion. And when we were relaxed and trusting around it, I think it's up there with the most glorious moments you could imagine, when you're just bathing in that expression of just, this is what you feel you're here to do. And there's nothing can touch it. It's just ball, just go flying back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so it was kind of like that until my demons kicked in, at which point that's where Sparks was like, oh, this could get interesting. And that's maybe where you assume
I think it's important to put the caveat in that the rugby season doesn't stop really at Christmas. So it wasn't like we'd had 2 weeks off and we were doing this. There was sometimes we played Boxing Day, or we even travelled on Christmas Day once down to Northampton for a game. But I did have mum and dad on speed dial to tell them at what time we'd be turning up for anything festivity related over Christmas, exactly. Just in case.
Well, I love the fact we can explore like this. It's such an awesome thing. But so the podcast all about human potential, and we're really keen to understand what that means for you. We know you know so many amazing books you've authored. You've got your own sporting career in the background. You've got your own career and your passions and purpose now, as well as, you know, everything that interests you, and the fact that you're sort of obviously got a real sporting connection as well. I think it's going to be an amazing chat. What does human potential mean to you?
Well, if I had to put it simply, I would say it's being the best that one can be. And then the question becomes, how do you achieve that level of potential? And I think that that's a very multifaceted answer. My first book, Bounce, was a critique of the idea that potential is determined exclusively or predominantly by talent alone. Clearly, talent is a factor, but I think that culturally we've often overemphasized its significance. And what I've been interested in doing in my career as a writer is deconstructing some of the other factors that are very, very important. Culture, motivation, mentoring, and the other conditions that are often so incredibly important. The other thing maybe is that it's sometimes we need to figure out what we wish to focus on. Because it is very difficult to reach one's potential in lots of different things at the same time. Given a limited amount of time available in any day, sometimes we have to focus. And I think there's a very interesting philosophical question about whether to narrowly focus on one thing and master it, as you clearly did, Johnny, or whether one leaves a more fulfilling life by doing a number of different things. My own view is that each of those can be a fascinating kind of a life. But again, I think particularly perhaps in the 80s and 90s, we were very interested in people who had a narrow focus and did things incredibly well, like a Mozart. But if I look at or a Tiger Woods or a Serena Williams, but I also think, having got a bit older, I have a huge admiration for people like my grandfather, who wasn't necessarily brilliant at any one thing, but he did his job very well. He was a tremendous father. He was a great friend. He was a wonderful volunteer at the local church. He was a preacher. I was with him on the day he died. We're very, very close. And when I think of his life, I think he lived a fantastic, fulfilling, morally serious life. I think he had a good life. He had a happy life. But he won't necessarily be remembered by anybody except the people who loved him. So there's many different aspects, I think, to potential. And, perhaps what I'd finish with in this particular answer is saying I think there's many different ways to do it.
I find that really fascinating. And the thing that maybe arises in me straight away is that understanding maybe on different levels of potential. There's the physical level, what you can materialize, what you can create, what you can leave, what you can, all that side. Then you've got the maybe more internal, still physical, but more internal understanding of what it can feel like. And like you said, living that life your grandfather lives, maybe where there's just such deep engagement and there's love and connection with what you're doing rather than the doing of it itself. Because this is, where I could get quite into my career of saying, you were really pushing the limits of what you were doing, but on an internal level, when there was any kind of sort of, the engagement was there, but the focus was purely on what does it look like? What are people thinking about it? What am I leaving? What am I creating? Am I doing enough? As opposed to how beautiful, which is going back to that thing with Sparks, kicking on a New Year's, or New Year's Eve night and just feeling like I feel free. I feel beautiful. And yet the skill level of what you're doing in that zone, as it were, those two can match up as well. But if you're going to choose one, would you choose the internal and not have it match up with the external, or have the external and not have the internal?
Well, I would say, I don't know, Sparks, what you think about this. I genuinely think that people can reach their potential in radically different ways. And I'll give you a quick example. One of the sports that I've loved the most over the course of my lifetime is men's tennis. And it's for a very good reason. The three greatest players of all time competed in the same era. And they were completely different in terms of technique, but also in the way they approached reaching their potential. So I'm obviously talking about Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and Novak Djokovic. Federer a little bit older. Nadal and Djokovic came along a little later, but they were all at their best at the same time. And their rivalry is one of the most privileged things for me to do, to watch. And I've been to some of the matches live. I've watched all of them on television. Me and my son go back and watch some of the classic finals between these three. And it's a remarkable story of competition, mutual discovery, evolution. But I watch them at a place called Arangi Park. Now, this is at Wimbledon, you've got centre court, you've got court number one. And then about 400 metres away, maybe a bit less, 200 metres away, there are the practice courts. And not many people go to the practice courts, but I go every year and I study how these people prepare. And I can't tell you the contrast between how these people do it. And Federer, you know he's about to arrive on the practice courts because you can hear giggling. He's laughing. He's joshing with whoever's his sparring partner. And he gets out his racket, does a warm-up. And then as they play, he's caressing the ball. He's stroking it. What came to my mind the first time I watched it is like watching Picasso do the preliminary sketches before a masterpiece. he's kind of toning up. And he'll serve from about a foot inside the line, very relaxed, languorous, elegant, And then he'll try a dink with a bit of side spin. And again, laughter, you know, banter. He's exploring his own creativity. And then, you know, he'll be three quarters of the way through the practice, and then you'll hear a bit of commotion. Nadal is arriving. And then, you know, this guy is sprinting up and down at the side of the court. You know, his biceps are bulging, you know, the focus, the intensity. And then when he's practicing, you know, the sweat is dripping. He's putting everything into it. And then, you know, an hour or two later, Djokovic turns up. And again, completely different. It's kind of measured, calibrated hitting. Quite serious, occasionally, you know, a bit of a conversation with Ivan Isovich or whoever his coach is. Now, these three people unquestionably reach their potential. But you just look at the way that they prepare before a match. And I've talked to people who have sparred with them when they're doing their, you know, their preparation camps, completely different methods. In other words, I think in a way, Johnny Sparks, you need to find what works for you. We're different people. We have our own idiosyncrasies, our own methods, but we need to, I think, explore what works for us. And that also is, I think, the testament to a great coach. Instead of saying everyone has to do it in exactly the same way, we've got a template that you have to fit into. I think coaches, particularly in individual sports, perhaps also, I don't know, in team sports too, need to be able to flex a little bit and to understand the drives, the ambitions, the neuroses, the passions of the individual. And that, I think, is also important to exploring potential.
Yeah, I mean, pardon me, I couldn't agree more with that. I say my background was predominantly either side of a short playing career, in which I tried to often joke that I filled Johnny's boots, mainly because the shirts were already printed and it was cheaper to just put an M in front of the surname on the back of the shirt. But
so, God, what position did you play?
Well, this was the funny thing. I played back row predominantly most of my life, and then in order to have a crack at trying to play at the highest level, I shifted to the backs, and within 18 months I was playing fly half in the Premiership.
Wow, okay.
But so we played 10 and 12 together, and it was undoubtedly, yeah, and I say this, the best times of my rugby life were when we played 10 and 12, because we did it as kids when we were 4 and 5 and upwards. And we had that ability to look across, nod, wink, know what the other one was thinking.
Right,
because you're talking about it in the evening, because we live together as well, when you're watching the greatest tries ever video and you're talking about your passions and wouldn't it be great to do this? And it's all there. However, so painfully during that career, I was just constantly injured. And as a result, because Sparks was so, and I'm going to say this because he won't, because he was so highly skilled and capable, people just sort of said, just do this job for us. So suddenly, like you said, you're playing 10, the general's position in the Premiership, and taking the Newcastle team beyond qualification of the European Cup, which is ludicrous for us, into the quarterfinals to play Paris from a number 10 position. But because you were so highly skilled and able to handle it, which I never realized the toll that took on you, maybe.
Well, it's funny that, Matthew, when you're talking about imposter syndrome on certain things, I found myself stood at fullback playing against Jason Robinson and Steve Hanley. And I've never been run around so many times in my life. So there were times where I did.
You weren't on your own in that. You weren't on your own.
No, I think it was the whole team that they ran around. But but obviously, getting back to what you were saying, either side of that, my love and my passion, as it continues to be, is the strength and conditioning side of, and health and fitness. So I was worked my way through various positions, but I ended up as head of S&C for the first team at Newcastle Falcons.
Oh, wow.
And one of the traits that you see is as much as you see that there are certain similarities between your very high elite performers. So we're talking, at one point we had about 50% of the England backline were all at Newcastle Falcons at once. All so different. Some you could, in order to get more from them, you would just hit them with a stick. Yeah. And others you would need to put your arm around them, talk to them differently, adjust your language. And likewise, when you're training in a group environment, everybody's essentially doing the same, but you are trying to tweak things so that certain people need to be challenged more because they are more capable, and others need to be to find their level so that they don't feel out of place but feel brought into the squad. And it's kind of one of the greatest questions, I suppose, within physical preparation is, if you've got teams and individuals that have won medals and championships, sometimes on a diet of cigarettes and lager, and others have gone through more like a Ivan Drago, Rocky IV type science experiment preparation, yet the end result is the same. How can you find common ground? Because there are a million routes to kind of essentially the same place.
First of all, Rocky IV doesn't get enough mentions in my view. I'll tell you what my kids love. You know the theme tune to that? What's it called? You know the one that goes... Dun 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 da 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 da.
Yeah.
It's such a great motivational tune, by the way. If I'm doing weights, I have that on. So thanks for the. I think that's right. It is Rocky IV.
Yes.
But so look, cigarettes are unlikely to work for. I mean, it's probable that the person who had cigarettes would have been even better had they not been. Oh. But the point you make is so. I don't know whether how if your audience likes. You know, this might be too geeky a point. I don't know, but. The way that when it comes to sports science, we've talked about psychology, haven't we, so far? You know, what are the right approaches to motivate people? But there's also a question in sports science in terms of preparation, how to get the body in the right place, diet, what kind of training one should do. The way scientists often establish the right protocols or methods is through something called the randomized double-blind controlled trial. And this is where... you test a particular thing on one group of people and you try something else. Take a medicine of some kind. You give some people the pill and other people a placebo, and you see whether there's a difference in outcome for the people taking the drug and the people who are taking just a sugar pill. And if there is a difference, you can say the drug has had an effect. So this is a very gold standard way of establishing causality. And this is what will be the basic benchmark for determining what kind of stretching people should do, what kind of physical conditioning. You want to know if it works or not. So you test it on some people and you give other people a different protocol. The problem with this, it's brilliant, but there is an Achilles heel, which is that if you're comparing two groups on average, you're missing the individual differences, if that makes sense. So you see, you know, this drug has on average improved for some people. But diet might be another example, forgive me. Let's say, for example, you establish that eating pasta, complex carbohydrates, gives the average person more energy. Fantastic. But none of us is an average person. We all vary. Because we have different genetics, different metabolisms, different gut microbiomes, we respond to the same food in slightly different ways. And where all social, medical, and human science are going at the moment is the personalization of medicine, the personalization of diet. I don't know if you've seen this app called Zoe, where they try and tailor a specific diet for your specific characteristics. Yeah. That, I think, is where coaching should be moving towards. We shouldn't be giving generic physical conditioning programs because we have different bodies. We respond to different protocols in different ways. And with repeat testing, and as we get bigger data sets and more sensitive sensors of the kind that can be built into iPhones, we're going to be able to make this a lot better for people. So Sparks, you know, sorry for, you know, a slightly involved answer. But in fact, I think this is where all the different branches of sports science are going to end up, the individualization of all the different things that matter for reaching our potential.
Well, we kind of had a little bit the king of that when we were at Newcastle, and Steve Black was Lions coach. He was Wales coach. He was at Newcastle, and he did everything he possibly could within a team environment to make everything individual. But of course, there was only so much that you could do to set up a gym.
That's right.
So what it was very much tailored to small changes physically, but massive changes mentally, like Spark saying, how you speak to them, how all that kind of stuff, but then also get you in on certain days when others weren't there and really work you differently. But he took us under his wing and trained us so differently, the two of us, definitely.
And did
he work at all with Joey Barton at any stage?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is funny. So that where I'm talking to you from is in Richmond in Southwest London.
Okay. Yeah.
It's called Ormond Road, where I live. And at the top of my road, there's a Costa, So about 50, 75 yards from where I'm talking here. And I used to go to the Costa. I now get a coffee from somewhere else. But lovely guys in Costa, by the way. I love the staff there. And a couple of years, Joey Barton used to live in Kew, very near me, because he played for
QPR,
London club. QPR, of course. Anyway, so I used to bump into Joe and spend a bit of time with him. And I went into Costa, and Joe was in there. And he said, you've got to meet this guy. And I'm not a huge follower of rugby, I have to admit. So I didn't know him. And is it Blackie, was he called?
Yeah.
Anyway, I start talking to him. And he goes, this guy's an unbelievable coach. Right, okay. 2 minutes go by, and I'm listening to him. 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And then I realize this guy is incredible.
Yeah.
Just his ability to connect with another human being. You know, he listened to me. He asked questions. And Joe was there smiling. And it's funny. I probably spent in my whole life, that 15 minutes, the only interaction I've ever had with him, I'll never forget him.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
No, he passed away, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
An amazing, amazing person. And I'm really sorry he's gone. He reminded me a lot, funnily enough, of my first table tennis coach, who was a guy called Peter Charters, his coach. He was a school teacher at the school on our road. And he had a passion for table tennis. He started a club, and table tennis, it's not as big as rugby, but it's not a small sport. You know, it's a good sort of 100,000 people who play. And more than half the top players in Britain in the 1980s came from my single road, Silverdale Road in Reading, where wow. I grew up. And it was because of this coach and what he had. He understood us as individuals. He understood, he knew who I was. He knew the buttons to press. You know, we trusted this person. Yeah. The other thing, and we should talk about this because I've got really interested in this. He also understood something that I think we're forgetting in the world today, which is occasionally you need to give strong, honest, difficult feedback. If I didn't turn up for practice or I was going through the motions, he wouldn't say, well done, Matthew. That was a great session to protect my feelings. He'd say, Matthew, you didn't come in and deliver today. That wasn't good enough. That honesty is, if you want to talk about that, I'll talk about that a lot. I think we are confusing in the world today that kindness or being nice is sugarcoating the truth. We need to hear the truth. If I got to the end of my career and my forehand topspin technique wasn't very good and my coach said, your forehand topspin technique was defective, but I never mentioned it because I didn't want to hurt your feelings. Yeah. That's a disaster. It means I've spent years playing table tennis without fulfilling my potential. You know, that feedback needs to be respectful, sure. But unless we get that unvarnished honesty, and that's why I think having a trusting relationship with a coach means that they can be honest without you getting offended because you know they've got your back. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
For me is absolutely fundamental to great coaching, great teaching, great mentoring, great relationships with our children. And perhaps the reason I'm emphasizing it, we're talking on Monday, the 19th of February. On Friday, I had lunch with Sean Dyche, Everton manager, and I've put the interview in the Times today. That was what he was all about. The importance of trusting honesty.
Wow. Go on, Sparks.
No, I was going to say, just because it ties in with what you're saying, Matthew, and also just because we've spoken about Blackie, but he had these incredible ways of letting people know and have that feedback without maybe having to directly say it. And right. Also, one of the sort of the nuances of coaching, particularly in team sports, is you have to accommodate all these different personalities and histories and backgrounds and belief systems, but pull towards a common culture
and
a goal. So one example is when Blackie and I were coaching, we had a traditional pre-season training session at Long Sands in Tynemouth, which was at the bottom of a ramp, run the beach, up the other side, down the ramp, across the beach, up the ramp, down the steps, as fast as you can. I think Johnny had the record actually, although he'll probably deny it, but it was about sort of 8.5-9 minutes if you were flying. Bearing in mind we had some guys that were 130 kilos plus, they weren't hitting those sorts of times. But one of the amusing things was Blackie said, right, I've got a feeling that a few guys are going to sandbag this. So if anyone mentions going to Starbucks or getting a coffee within 6 minutes of finishing, everybody's going to do it again. And he also predicted who was going to say it. And sure enough, that exactly played out. And then after that, you could see that the baseline effort for that session was always exactly where it needed to be.
Right.
And it just took that one sort of harsh consequence of not hitting the required standards for that particular thing. And everybody knew it. And everybody understood the message.
It's emotional intelligence, isn't it? I think that we need that. We talk about intelligence and IQ, but that ability to understand other people, to be able to listen in order to understand them. I think that is really, really important. What was Blackie's background, by the way?
He wrote a book
which you can purchase, just called Blackie, and it tells a lot of it. But it was sort of nightclub doors, sprinting, powerlifting, boxing, working with police, working against police, working with detectives. Everything.
Did he have a criminal background?
No, I don't think so as so much, no. but he had an incredibly, he used to tell us stories that your initial response was, that's got to be BS.
Yeah.
You'd find out it's just not. Yeah.
There's very few books where you can go from attempting to bring Ronnie Biggs back to England and searching for Lord Lucan to Wales's greatest unbeaten winning streak under Graham Henry, all in like two chapters. So
yeah, exactly.
It's an incredible,
but that's
an amazing dude.
That trust and that honesty you're talking about,
right,
within a relationship, I think is fundamental to this other character. Certainly for me, because a lot of my life was built out of a distrust, which was just a fear, a massive fear that I experienced throughout my entire life. And it manifested in obviously distrust, as it does. You know, everything has that sense that I'm going to see the threat before I see the opportunity. And therefore, until someone gives me absolute clarity, I'm going to struggle to trust them. That was my default sort of earlier on. And with Blackie, he covered that ground immediately. There was something that just let you know there was authenticity, there was absolute honesty. And he was there, Sparks said he was there for you in such a way that I remember we were doing a drill, we used to try and keep this football up against a wall, and there was three of us and you weren't allowed to let it bounce. So you're all volleying this ball against a wall. We were trying to, he wanted us to do a certain number. He was very much about, at the end of a training session when you're fatigued, just like, right, skill drill, get it done. Yeah. And we couldn't do it, the three of us. And these other two guys were getting a bit, but I was in my, this has to happen mode. And Blackie was like, okay, leave it there. And I was like, one more, let's go again. And he let me have a couple of those. And he said, let's leave it there. And I went, one more. And geez, he let me know that it was done. As in, I had to learn what was courageous for me in that moment was not to keep going again, but to face the vulnerability of realizing, which we can talk about with fixed mindset, that it hasn't happened, handle it.
Yep.
As opposed to the default of, I'll always have another go. It's like, handle this and grow from it. But geez, when he shouted, it was like I knew, but it didn't change anything. Within 2 minutes, I'm there afterwards having a chat with him, and it hasn't touched a thing in the relationship.
Yeah.
The fact that he's let me have both barrels, but it hasn't touched it. And I think that is what you're talking about. Whereas if you don't have that trust, someone lets you have both barrels in a
That's right.
Yeah. I suppose the question is, did you go back and do the keepy ups once he left?
Yeah, exactly. Go on, Maddie.
But I was just going to say, I think you're absolutely right that it's almost like the meaning of the words depends on the strength of the relationship with the person who's expressing them. If I don't trust my coach, and he says or she says your forehand topspin technique is defective, what I'm hearing is you're trying to knock my confidence.
Yeah,
you're probably trying to help my opponents. If, on the other hand, I trust the coach, I'm hearing you're trying to help me improve. I may disagree with you, but let's go and have a look at a videotape and see who's right. You know, the quality of the relationship, and it doesn't mean you necessarily have to like. Trust is different to liking. It's different from necessarily wanting to spend free time with someone.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's about, more than anything else, being committed to the same goal, being committed to the same outcome. And if my coach's goal is for me to be the best table tennis player I can be, that creates a level of trust, because that is alignment with my objective to be the best that I can be. And, you know, just one other thing on, you know, we've talked about understanding individuals, understanding people's own idiosyncrasies. And I think that's really, really important. But you are right. In a team sport, there needs to be 100% alignment on what we're seeking to achieve. There needs to be alignment on what is our purpose, how we get there, how we bring our best selves to that purpose can be different. But you have to be, and you have to align on the tactics or strategy we're going to deploy. But I think all of that can interlock. They can all be true at the same time.
I think your common purpose, goal, and that connection to that why.
Yeah.
It looks, it's so intelligent in its power that it looks after where detail might be missing or where there's confusion. It looks after, I think about the South African rugby team that just won the World Cup, 3 games by 1 point. None of them looked, you know, that perfect or pretty. And there's times where it's all over the place, but it just works somehow. And you feel like you can't, people think, take away that emotional touch and think, well, let's get all the detail in place. But as soon as one of those details falls out, the rest of it falls out with it. But when you have that commitment to the goal,
that's right,
there's an intelligence in the scramble defense or in the adaptation of a player to another player that you can't explain other than just, I wanted it that much, I had to understand it almost.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I watched the fight. They were a bit lucky in the fight. The final was a brilliant contest, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Back and forth, yeah, exactly.
There was a refereeing decision near the end. Was it, because I was watching with somebody in a pub who's an expert on rugby, who said it was a mistake. What was the fallout from that in the end? Was it considered an error?
There was in the final, there was a red card on New Zealand's side, which meant they played 14 men for a lot of the game, but still managed to challenge. In the quarterfinal when England played, there was a penalty at the end when England were 2 points up.
Right.
There was also the Richie Mwanga's try.
Oh,
where
gosh,
a
yeah.
Pass was called.
Yeah.
And they were questioned. I think this is.
Or a knock on. No, it was a knock on. It was a knock on at the line out. Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever. And there was a question of, well, you have that thing of now with the TMOs and the video refs of, well, if there's something spotted after the game, you can't go back, call everyone into the stadium and do a different presentation of the cut. But
I think just on all these points, you were mentioning about the ability to. To everyone, what works for you, finding out what works for you and how that sits with your potential. Now that connects you to potential. That's a really big part of what we talk about. And what's interesting for me, I'll get you to sort of give your version of this, is the understanding that everything's constantly moving. So whatever you find at a certain age, you have to keep exploring. Otherwise, you actually think, okay, that just connected me to something amazing. I'll do it again tomorrow. And it's not quite there. You then have to find that subtlety, which I think comes from this journey of being like, you cannot get there through the gross black and whites of I do this. It tunes me in. There's a constant need to sort of drop into a deeper inner sort of sensitivity almost.
Yeah. And I would say I agree with all of that. And, you know, we talked about individuality. I would say there are two things that I think are true of everybody who reaches their potential, like, so almost like two non-negotiables, which it's worth emphasizing here, because we can all try and be the best we can be in different ways, but there are certain things that have to be in place. One of them is obvious. You have to be passionate about whatever it is you're seeking to do well at.
Absolutely.
One of the tragedies, I think, of some parenting is we're going to decide on behalf of the young person what they're going to achieve, and then we're going to force them to do it. Pushy parenting. And it often comes with the best of intentions. And you see some young people who reach quite high levels, but it's too big a contradiction. If you're doing what you're doing, not because you care about it from the inside, but to please a parent, the psychological tension is too, and eventually they burn out. And it can be quite tragic when that happens. What's interesting about kids who internalize the motivation, so they're doing it for its own sake, is instead of the parent saying, you have to go, often they're like, come on, take me to the football, you know, take me to the golf, take me to the rugby. They're dragging their parent. Of course, every now and again, they might say, I don't want to go today, and you might need to give them a nudge. But it's a very different thing having to give them a nudge now and again to every day basically coercing them to go, or them going out of fear of what it might mean. So it's sometimes called in psychology intrinsic motivation. This is motivation that comes from within and is directed towards a particular goal or target that has meaning for its own sake. The meaning for its own sake, I think, is important too, because occasionally I think with young footballers, but I've seen it with young golfers as well and other sports, is that when the money starts coming in, instead of seeing this as a passion, a privilege, I love this game, it becomes something which is transactional. You know, I think this, some people disagree with this, but I think it affected Rory McIlroy a little bit. He used to bounce around the court, loved golf, been playing from a young age, and then he got this big contract from Nike and he became a brand, and he was playing because of, and it subtly changes how one engages with the sport, the creativity. And I think he's trying to rediscover that kind of inner love. Federer's never lost it. Djokovic, Nadal, Serena Williams, you know, Muhammad Ali never lost it. You can see when people are still, they're earning money, but it's almost like an additional benefit. They just feel it's wonderful to be able to explore. You know, great art. There's great studies on art. Commissioned art, where somebody pays you to do a job for them for money, is less good than art that is created for its own sake. And here's the irony. The art that's created for its own sake gets a higher price as a consequence. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It needs to be almost like an unintended consequence. So that was the first one. True intrinsic passion is very, very important. And then the other one is resilience. Because no matter how passionate we are about something, if it's a worthy goal, a tough goal, a stretching goal, we'll occasionally fail or suffer setbacks. And having the ability to dust oneself down, get up, learn the lessons and carry on, that's another non-negotiable for me.
I think the passion side of it, I've got a small sort of facility where I work with training with people of got some sport, to sometimes I've got a few guys that come in that have never been to a gym before in their life. And the processes that you notice, where if someone's facing a task that's challenging, first up, if they're really committed and passionate about achieving the goal, they'll try it or they'll walk away from it. And then you have the next step of when you approach it, there's an internal negotiation, a conversation going on in your head of one voice going, oh, geez, this sounds like it's going to be really tough. And the other voice saying, no, you've got this. Let's crack into it. We can do this. We can do this. And I think that the passion and the commitment to that goal leads to the more occasions that you win that negotiation, which leads to resilience, because you build a confidence in your own ability to, when you put yourself in the crosshairs of a challenge, which could go either way, and you come out with some positive outcomes, even if the outcome is, I failed the task, but I had a crack at it. Yeah. That builds that resilience. And it's a small momentum over time, and start with low hanging fruit. And then you just increase and ramp up the challenge when it becomes appropriate for that individual.
Yeah. And there's also long-term commitment. Yeah. Sorry, Sparks. Yeah. And there's also this literature on habituation. I don't know if you've read any of the literature. I only recently read the sort of three or four big books on this and got to know, is it Wendy Wood? And there's another great British psychologist who's written on habituation, that to the extent that in moving towards a particular goal, we can habituate some of the routines that are required to get there, so that we don't need to, as it were, go through the internal negotiation each time. That seems to be quite important. And I think there's something to be written on, for what it's worth, on how the wider cultural evolution of societies is driven by certain types of processes of habituation. But anyway, that's a wider conversation. But I think my understanding is that if too many, I'd be interested to hear your view, Sparks, but going to the gym, if too much of it is a daily negotiation, you're unlikely to stick to the resolution to do it two or three times a week. But the moment it becomes habituated, so that you'll go, like for example, when you drive a car, you're not necessarily thinking about how you're moving the steering wheel and the gear stick, because it's habituated. It's you're thinking of something else while you're driving. And when something becomes a habit, you're on your way to the gym just because that's what you do at a particular time and it's part of the routine that one has embedded in one's life. And there are interesting, I mean, there are best-selling books on this. I wish I'd got into this area earlier in life as an author, but there are some great techniques to bring that habituation to life.
Yeah, I think, and Johnny, you can speak to this. I know within your world of what you're doing with coaching is that's the art of coaching, is finding the level that someone's at and then setting the kind of the chain of progress at a level where you are going to get enough of those small wins to begin with to build momentum. And that is what, when people start to think, do you know what, I'm actually feeling the benefits of this that I'm doing, that's where I believe you start to get that habituation. But it has to be motivated by some form of benefits from doing it. Otherwise, yeah, exactly, you'll fall out of love with it very, very quickly.
I think having that challenge must exceed your confidence zone to a degree in order for growth. You know, like that whole thing about playing rugby is every damn game, you've got that ridiculous butterfly feeling. Every game. I remember, Sparks, you and I played in that seven-a-side tournament against Gosforth Grammar School's teachers. Now, these are just like teachers. And they're sort of 50, 60, 45, and we're these sort of 25-year-old pros. And in the changing room beforehand, there's the same damn butterflies. Because the unknown is such a beautiful thing. You just don't know. And when you go into something where you just know everything, it's within your confidence space, and there isn't that worthiness or meaning to it, which is really interesting.
That was one of the most painful defeats we ever suffered.
not a chance. Don't leave that out there. The other thing I just wanted to say, which really struck a chord with me, was when you were talking about passion and excitement. Because I think in terms of what we're talking about, team space and the individual focus in order to find each player's passion and excitement. What is it that excites them, and be able to allow them to get that, which is another way of saying getting their strong points into the plan, so that everyone feels like there's something for me in here, because I can get passionate, excited about this. But when the coach, as you say, has that idea, I know how it should be done, and I know what your best is. You don't. I know what should be exciting for you. I'll set that for you. Then when it comes to just before game time, what you end up is the coach feeling that the players don't have that excitement and passion for their goals. So you then coerce them to getting up for it by trying to stoke anger and fear instead of passion and excitement. So you go to Blackie never had to do this with me. If you don't get in the gym tomorrow, you're going to start dropping off and players are going to start overtaking you. Didn't ever need to, because I knew that I wanted to be there, but also he knew how to make sessions exciting for me. So he never had to challenge me on that. But what you'd find in team environments, people resort to that fear and anger so quickly, because there's this sense that your passion and excitement won't get you there. But when you're with a team where everything's just happening, the coach never goes there. The coach is just like, can see it, can feel it, that the players want to be there.
Yeah, fear. I mean, I think, you know, as a motivational device, it's overrated, I think. I mean, with a very simple activity, if you're fearful that unless you do what you're being told, you're going to get shot, it may make you work harder. As soon as you're in a complex creative domain like rugby or playing the piano, imagine somebody saying to a concert pianist about to play Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, I've got a gun to your head, and you miss one note and I'm going to blow your brains out. Are they going to play creatively? And are they going to play beautifully? They're going to mess up very early on. Whereas many of the things that really matter in the world today, at work, in sport, you know, I'm a writer. It's creative. You're not trying to narrow your focus. You're trying to retain a broad focus. And that's very true in team sport, by the way. The great rugby players and footballers are capable of reading, typically, what is happening in different parts of the pitch. So they're able to anticipate where the ball is going to go and therefore how to execute very quickly to get to the ball to a teammate who's running into the space where the ball is about to land. These holistic capacities emerge from what's sometimes called right brain capability. And fear tends to push us over to the left brain with a very narrow focus. So if you think of a, it's a very difficult book, but a neuroscientist called Ian McGilchrist wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary. And the master is the right brain. The left brain should be used for narrow focused tasks. But what we really need most of the time is that wider, broader focus as a writer to bring different ideas together, to tell a story, as a rugby player to integrate into a wider team. The same in so many of the important jobs in the world today. By the way, it'd be interesting in the future to see whether AI can really engage with these holistic problems. I think it's going to be a kind of an interesting political question in the coming decades.
I'm going to leap on what you were just saying there, because it's so important that there's two parts of preparation for a performance, as I see it. One is the information, the game plan, the data, the moves you're going to do, you know, the detail and making sure everyone knows this, so you've got you can get that alignment on the structure. The other part of preparation is the players excited, passionate, feeling good, worthy and deserving, because that feeds the creative, responsive side. Whereas the structure, you know, the structure is important to give the direction and guidance, but then structure is lifeless until it has that other part in. And therefore this part that's missed is, we, through that fear and anger, you go heavy on the detail, distrust, we don't know enough, more detail. And as a player, I did that to myself. I ended up playing most of the game intellectually, what you're saying, left brain, just kind of like work it out. And you lose that sense of coming off the field afterwards and saying, I can't believe I just did that. Did you see what I just came up with? Didn't even know I could do it. Those moments become less and less as you become more of a person that knows how it should be done. And I think that's so, so powerful going forward, because we always talk about children to say, what's the best way? You know, do they need to learn how to jump in the line out? And what about the binding? You're kind of like, allow them to feel able to respond to anything.
And yes, yeah, definitely. But would you agree also that, you know, when you're learning a task for the first time, you know, for me in table tennis, well, actually, should you do it? I mean, I think this, I haven't figured out my own opinion on this yet, but the typical way of thinking about coaching is when you start figuring out how to jump at a line out or catch a ball or hit a moving table tennis ping pong ball, you need to kind of consciously figure out the technique. Yeah. Like with driving, you need an instructor to tell you what you need to do so that you can consciously control the way you're moving your foot and your wrist and your trunk. But then over time, as you practice it more and more, it becomes more unconscious. And of course, you need it to be largely unconscious, because in the heat of battle, if you're focusing on how you're moving your wrist, then you're not able to integrate all the other things you need to be doing at the same time in order to win a rugby match. But I now kind of think that we, even in the beginning stages, we overcoach. There's a cricketer, I don't know if you're into cricket, called Steve Smith. Have you heard of it? He's an Australian cricketer.
Yeah.
He's got a very unusual technique. Yeah. And how he learned it was not by being told how to move the bat, but just being bowled at over and over again and organically.
Beautiful.
Through unstructured play, figuring out how he needed to. And his technique is something no coach would ever have dreamt of. And he's one of the best batsmen ever. The best batsman ever is someone called Don Bradman.
Yeah.
Totally self-taught, throwing, I think, like a golf ball and hitting it with a stump. And again, the technique isn't one you would ever imagine. And it's almost like we have the ability to adapt to the stimuli that we're being subject to, and to create really wonderful techniques without a lot of coaching. You know, maybe in some domains, like learning how to fly, there's going to be certain types of checklists or forcing functions that we need to do. I'm sure there is a bit of that. But traditionally, I think, in education, in sport, in innovation, in technical innovation, we've been too top-down and not enough learning by doing. You know, one example is you know, James Dyson. He created a wonderful vacuum cleaner, but he did it by testing and learning, and it was a very evolutionary process. It's, you know, I think it's the way to go a lot of the time.
I think a lot of that harks back to what we were kind of speaking earlier, which is about the personalization and individualization. Mm. But it's also, exactly.
Yep.
It depends within which situation you do it, because it's easier to do with small numbers, lots of face-to-face. I suppose it's the same argument as the impact that written word can have versus a face-to-face video call versus actually meeting someone in person. There's something about the transfer right. of energy and understanding is so much greater when you're actually in the same geographical space as someone.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, if you think about something like call centers, they have these scripts, generic yeah. scripts. So if you get a particular query at a particular time, you follow the script. But of course, no two queries are ever quite the same. And we know from the data that call center workers who can listen to what the person's asking and adapt to what their concern happens to be, they get a much better result. Mm. And that's why, you know, being with somebody in the room, even where you can see who they are, you can look into their eyes, you can really gather who they are, you're likely to get a better result. All of what we've been saying is really the individual, the organic is better than the generic and the top down. I think that is a very yeah. important lesson that goes well beyond sport.
Yeah, well, I think, go on, Sparks.
No, I was just going to say, but I think you do have these issues of scale where you could, let's say because we've been speaking about, if Blackie had just solely focused on Johnny in every training session and ignored the other 35 guys that needed to come through the gym and train, it's about the numbers, what you have and doing the best you can on a sliding spectrum, let's say, of what's the most I can do to individualize this, albeit with the tools and the opportunities I have.
But I think the scaling is a lot easier now, Sparksy, because for two reasons. One is big data, on the one hand, enables us to figure out, let's take diet, medicine, that can help us to individualize it for people. The second is I think we can create flexibility in spaces. You know, like in a car, you can move the seat back or forward. So that your leg size, you design cars and airplane cockpits in a way that you can, as it were, move the height of the seat, change the size of a whole range of different things in order to make it fit you. I think in the way we have workplaces, hours that people work, and also even with what you were talking about, management, if a great manager has 10 people who report to them, and they're flexible with these 10 people, and those 10 people have their own direct reports. Do you see how you can scale that through an organization of 100,000 people? I'm not saying, I don't want to overdo it in any way. I'm not saying that it could be completely flexible work. I think we do need some constraints, some rules, some non-negotiables. But I do think that having some level of flexibility is a much more scalable proposition now than it ever has been.
I think a really important part for me is the willingness of the individual, though.
Definitely, yeah.
And this is that back to that passion, excitement, or even just that willingness to go somewhere, ultimately into a space of I have to start taking ownership of what's happening on the inside of me. Otherwise, like you said, for example, the kicking thing. If I'm coaching someone who's kicking, you'll set the ingredients all around them and the internal everything and just go right bang, and you get an inspired response. The ball just flies. And you kind of go, we did that in 2 minutes. Now, when you go away, you've got the whole damn week. Imagine what you can do with a whole week. And yet when the person comes back at the end of the week, you're like, what's happened? You're a shivering wreck. So what are we doing on our own time to connect to our own potential? That means that, like Steve Smith, you hit something, it doesn't work out, but you reconnect to, I've heard you say before, which I love, humility and evaluation, focusing into confidence and execution. And that for me is that opening, connect to potential, that focusing in, sharp, opening again, and you get this beautiful flowing, almost like wing sort of work of a bird. Open, receive, execute, open. But if you don't open because you're constantly executing, you turn yourself into a tense ball. If you just open the whole time, you never commit. But unless you can open yourself,
when I felt that distrust, I couldn't do it. So I got, so through my career, as I aged, I got more angry, more contracted, more dark, less possibility. Now, having people around to help is amazing, but the willingness has to be there to face that when you're on your own, I guess.
Yeah. And yeah, I love that. The wing. I hadn't thought of it like that, but kind of opening up and contracting, that kind of cycle, I completely relate to. And then on personal accountability, very, very important. Because we all, I think, are accountable to ourselves if we've set a target to be the best that we can be, to make sure that we do whatever it requires. And it can be hard. The work can be hard. Passion gets you through it, but there are always going to be those moments where the choice comes down to you. And the question is, what do you do in that moment? But in the end, and here's a kind of a philosophical point, I think a life lived in that way is a much more enjoyable life than one lived without passion, where one doesn't set challenges that stretch one's capabilities, particularly if there's real meaning and purpose in the challenges we set for ourselves. You know, I love Only Fools and Horses. And I think Del Boy is somebody who works hard, gives himself a go. Yeah. There's an episode called The Jolly Boys Outing, right, where they go to Margate.
Okay.
Del, Trigg, Rodney, Boycie, Mike from the Nag's Head, they're all there. Mickey Pierce, Denzel.
Yeah, I know the ones. I'm picturing them all as you say this. Yeah.
And Rodney and Del, they go down the pier. And Del says to Rodney, he says, Rodney, I'm an achiever. I've never actually achieved nothing, mind you, but I've always been out in with a shout. And that is the kind of life I want to lead. Yeah, I'd love to achieve, but more than anything else, it's the journey. Giving yourself a chance. I was never very good at it. I was never in the top 20 of the world at table tennis, but you know, I made number one in Britain, and it was a great journey. I'm not the best writer, but I've given it a go. I try hard, and I'm passionate about it, and it's a fascinating life. And I think Del Boy, good old Del, he lived a fantastic life too.
I don't think we've ever finished a podcast on Only Fools and Horses story. And I think this might be the most beautiful place. But, you know, from my perspective, I think passion and excitement gives you the game in your life, and you've got to give yourself a chance.
Right.
Otherwise, yeah, I mean, like, so why is there passion if it's not to push you somewhere that you might be supposed to be? So, and I love that. We speak all the time about stay in the game. In other words, don't close the door. You've just thrown a ball on the floor. Don't close the door.
Right.
Stay in the game. Stay open.
You know, and do you have kids, by the way, either of you?
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
So how old are yours?
5.
I got 14 and 12.
Right. Sparksy, I showed an episode. So on was it Saturday night or Friday? Saturday night. So 2 nights ago, I showed them an episode of Only Fools and Horses. This is the one where Del ends up on a glider, and me and my wife are laughing.
I know the one. Yeah.
You know the one I mean? Yeah, yeah. We're laughing all the way through. And my kids, they love Friends, you know, and Modern Family. I thought they'd really love it, but they didn't get it at all. So I'm still, fingers crossed, I'm hoping in time they're going to get this.
In my house, Dad's cultural historical trips through movies and music sometimes lands well, and other times is... Yeah.
If
doesn't
you don't
do
know,
so well.
Crocodile
you
know Dundee, it. They didn't like at all. No. Didn't like at all, but they love Fawlty Towers.
How
they
dare they? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you never know.
Amazing. Matthew, do you know what? I mean, it's ludicrous. I love the fact that this conversation has gone exactly where it's gone. Thank you so much for making it such an exchange as well. Geez, I thought I was on the podcast. So I love that. It's beautiful. Giving us a chance to speak and open up. What a great thing. There's so much that we could get into. So one day in the future, sometime, if you're ever willing, it'd be lovely to sort of hit you up for a see where we are down the line evolution type conversation. But thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Amazing.
Awesome stuff. Thank you so much.